people can just buy Bitcoin or Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy, then why are they going to be buying treasuries? And so until they figure this out, they're going to continue to be cannon fodder for Michael Saylor and Bitcoin. Michael Saylor's moat grows every time somebody tries to cross it.
Is Bitcoin the only life raft that we can really have to, I guess, save us from hyperinflation?
I have to say, I was pretty skeptical when Trump started talking about this, saying that he's going to be buying Bitcoin, because the way that I see it is, if you buy Bitcoin as a U.S. government, this is essentially a...
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Saifedean Ammous in the house, author of the Bitcoin Standard, the Fiat Standard, and much, much more. But Saifedean, I heard a recent interview about with you describing how if you're using the U.S. dollar, you're essentially funding the U.S. government or allowing the U.S. government to continue the tyranny of what they are doing. Now, I have a question for you. Based on what the events have transpired here with the potential of a U.S. strategic reserve, how do you view the mix of Bitcoin and the U.S. dollar with everything that's continued to transpire here?
First of all, thanks for having me, Brandon. It's fun to be here. So I think generally, in a world in which the government can print money, every time you hold money, you are contributing to its value going up. And every time the government increases the supply, it devalues your money. So every time you let them devalue your money by holding it, you are effectively transferring some of your purchasing power to them. So everybody who holds dollars is essentially funding and financing the operation of the U.S. government and the U.S. banking system, which most people don't really think of in these terms, but I think it's entirely accurate in financial terms, because that's what's called seniorage. And governments are pretty open about the fact that they like to run on seniorage. And so they've got significant amounts of revenue that come to them effectively from being able to devalue the money. And it's a little bit more complicated than just printing pieces of paper and increasing the supply of money. Most money is already digital, and they don't quite just print the money or create the money. They borrow, and then the central bank creates money for them to. So there's a bit of smoke and mirrors involved. But ultimately, what they're doing is that they're increasing the supply of money and devaluing your money. So for me, the best thing that Bitcoin does is that it kills this grift. And this is one of the oldest grifts that humanity has ever known. This, you know, money is like the crowning achievement of human civilization, when we're able to get out of the jungle long enough to start trading with one another, building a civilization and start exchanging goods. That's a huge step. And then the next step is when we discover a generalized medium of exchange and start using it as a way for us to trade with one another, which facilitates our ability to trade with people from all over the world and allows us to exchange money, exchange goods with people that don't need to have the things that we want and want the things that we have. So we can just exchange things with anybody. It allows trade to become so much more involved and complicated and sophisticated and spread out all over the world. And it allows us to save for the future. So it's a huge deal. Money is a huge achievement. And then as soon as we get a form of money going, somebody comes up with this most catastrophic of ideas, which is, hey, let's just make a little bit more of this money, and then we'll be able to have money for the nice things that we want, and nobody will notice. And this is when civilization begins to take a horrible turn to the worst, and things begin to fall apart, and wars happen, and world wars happen, and all kinds of horrific things happen. And once government has this form of money that it can continue to print from, which is what they've done in the 20th century, because money needs to move quickly, and gold can't really move quickly, so governments have a monopoly on bank settlement, which allows them to continue to force you to use their currency, because you can't use a banking system other than one that involves their currency. All of that means that they have an enormous amount of seniorage and money that they take from people. And that's why in the last century, I think we've had a lot of war and a lot of murder, and Bitcoin ends this. Now, I have to say, I was pretty skeptical when Trump started talking about this, saying that he's going to be buying Bitcoin, because the way that I see it is, if you buy Bitcoin as a U.S. government, This is essentially a terrible vote of no confidence in the US dollar, and it is advertising to the rest of the world that we've moved on from the dollar to the next best thing, and we're printing dollars and dumping them on you, whereas we are buying Bitcoin. So you're telling the world, anybody who's got a couple of brain cells running between their ears should be able to draw the connection here. They can print dollars at no cost, but they don't hold the dollars. They choose to hold the Bitcoin. So I think this would be massively undermining in the confidence. It would massively undermine the confidence in the dollar, which I think would be a good thing, because I think if the US moves to a Bitcoin standard, it can't print money. And I think a lot of the world's problems are solved if the US can't print money. And I don't care how much Bitcoin they have. Once they have Bitcoin, they can't print it. So every time they want to spend money on something stupid that doesn't make a positive return, they are going to end up with less Bitcoin. So I welcome this new transition to a world of fiscal responsibility that Bitcoin is going to endanger.
Now, do you think that it's the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve will actually solve that? Or do you see them attempting to potentially print some money in order to buy Bitcoin, at least in the short term? Obviously, that would affect things negatively in the long term, meaning they wouldn't be able to purchase as much Bitcoin. But, you know, it seems like with Trump, he just said, you know, although, you know, lowering interest rates isn't necessarily printing money per se, it is another form of QE. He wants low interest rates and he wants to buy Bitcoin. So it seems like it's kind of, you know, a juggling act here, at least initially.
Not quite. They're pretty much both pushing in the same direction, which is dump the dollar and pump Bitcoin. So, you know, lowering interest rates is likely to lead to more money creation, so more dollars. And this is something that politicians generally like, because they like to pump liquidity into the economic system, into the banking system early on in their reign, because it leads to an economic boom and people enjoy it and people like it. So I think it's highly likely that Trump is going to push for that. Again, the Federal Reserve is a little bit complicated, and it's not clear how much authority he has over it. And it's also not clear how happy they are going to be to watch him buy Bitcoin. So it's really interesting. So I was quite skeptical of the idea that he would be able to pull it off. I thought it was a good promise to make, because it's unlikely that he would be able to fulfill it, because he's not likely to get a majority in Congress that would support it. Because realistically, I think the majority of Democrats are not going to want to support this. And I think there's enough sway in the banking industry, in the Republican Party, that they would likely be able to secure a majority between Republicans and Democrats for this. That's my intuition. But I don't know. I mean, Trump seems serious, and he's been very serious with all these executive orders that he's issued. He's got in a ceasefire in Gaza. He doesn't look like he's just here to do a victory tour for the election that he feels he was robbed of in 4 years ago. He is here to settle scores and kick ass. And so something tells me that he's going to be pretty serious about it. I'd say more serious than I would have expected a few months ago. So, yeah, I don't know how it's going to go. It's certainly very exciting, and I'm certainly glad that I have Bitcoin. And if I didn't have Bitcoin, I would be scrambling to get some.
Yeah, it is interesting, the little, I guess, the dichotomy it seems like they're playing here, because it seems like there hasn't been a lot of faith in the U.S. dollar. I mean, they're talking about, you know, the asset. It seems like it's almost inevitable asset inflation is going to happen with lower interest rates. And, you know, we're going to see potentially Bitcoin start to run here. But is there a negative from this scenario of, you know, potentially lowering interest rates, although Trump is looking to lower taxation? And because, you know, we still don't really have inflation under wraps. I mean, if one of my favorite websites is Govflation, which looks at the basket of goods from 1982, comparatively to how they're comparing the basket of goods now when they calculate CPI. And that CPI print is still over 10% now if you're looking at the old basket of goods. So inflation isn't under wraps. And then we're going to have QE, but then we're also buying Bitcoin. So, you know, how do you see this scenario playing out? Is Bitcoin the only life raft that we can really have to, I guess, save us from hyperinflation?
Yeah, Bitcoin really is the only thing. I don't think there are any other options. And I don't think anybody can make a serious case for why something can beat Bitcoin in this case. So really, to begin the question from the actionable information is, yes, Bitcoin is the answer. Now, in terms of how it plays out, look, I've given up on prognosticating fiat markets because it's sort of silly. It's kind of like betting on WWE games, which are all rigged. And so it's kind of silly to be out there betting on a rigged market because a lot of people know about the rigging. And there's, it's not like when you're trying to bet on an actual sport where people are competing and there's no rigging, then there is some value to the knowledge at least. You know, you understand the sport, so you can figure it out. Maybe you can make money. Generally, people get ruined. But at least, in the example, when you're betting on a rigged game, I think that's just ridiculous. I think you have to be a very, very, very special kind of gambler to bet on that. And that's the kind of gambler who gambles on fiat markets. So I've given up on having strong opinions about what's going to happen to whatever government statistics people tend to care about. So GDP, inflation, unemployment, all of these are government statistics. And, you know, they could do anything they want over the next 5 years. And for me, it doesn't really matter. I've got the winning move, which is to get into Bitcoin. And that's worked out better than anything else. So I imagine all of the time that I could have spent going over market analysis of fiat markets and balance sheets and all kinds of stuff to try and figure out how to predict what's going to happen with fiat markets. And then no matter how well you do, you're not going to outperform Bitcoin. And so therefore, you might as well just stick to Bitcoin. So having said that, I think there's a chance that this kind of low interest rate policy, if Trump manages to get it, it might be inflationary. You combine that with the reduction in taxes, and then that could actually be more, and it could also be inflationary. So you're getting more and more inflationary pressure in both cases. And so I think it's an outcome that is also politically tenable, in a sense that there are a lot of liabilities for the US government and for governments around the world, and inflation is a way for them to reduce the real value of these liabilities. So that's how their bonds are going to effectively default, which is that they're going to be devaluing the amount of money that they're going to be paying you, which is going to make things easier for them because as inflation happens, their income goes up. So as long as they keep rigging the CPI statistics, then they've got a nice little spread to make, where you just get poorer and they pay you the CPI for your welfare and for all of their expenditures and social security and so on, whereas their tax income can go up by the increase in the nominal money supply relatively because people are spending more money because they have more money in their pockets. So I think inflation is sort of the inescapable end game. And people who don't see this generally put too much weight in CPI. And so they think, well, okay, inflation went up because of COVID, but now it's back under control. But really, I like to think of inflation in the way that Michael Saylor explains it, that inflation cannot be understood as a number. It's not a single number. It's a vector. And it's a vector of numbers, which together give you an idea about how things are changing. But it depends on what you are purchasing. And so you can identify particular trends. So real estate in desirable neighborhoods, places where you can be safe, where your kids can walk around in the street, that's the sort of thing that is going up at around 7, 8, 9% per year. You think of high-quality healthcare, high-quality education, all of these things are increasing at a significant value, at a significantly higher rate than CPI. then you got look at things that increase at rates that are similar to CPI. These are usually industrial goods, maybe things like cars, electronics, something like that. They go up, but they go up a little bit, but also the quality improves over time. So then when they're calculating the CPI, they calculate that reduction, the improvement in quality, as if it is a reduction in price. And so that allows them to print more money. So the faster your laptop goes, the more money they can print, because, you know, the Apple or Lenovo company is making the processing power for you. And the more processing power they put in, the more the central bank can rob from you, basically, is what they're saying, which is just a ridiculous kind of pseudoscience. And then there are the goods that decline in value. And these are things like digital goods, where you see things decline. You know, the subscription for, say, cloud services, it keeps getting cheaper because these things are a lot cheaper. And so this is how it is. So if you focus your basket of goods towards digital and electronic and industrial things, and you don't choose to eat fresh food is another one that goes up significantly, whereas, you know, junk food goes down, goes up a lot less. So junk food is usually below CPI. Good food is usually above CPI. And so if you stick to industrial waste for your food, if you stick to living in places where you don't want to live, and if you stick to consuming electronics and buying things that are industrial, then you can keep your personal CPI down. But if you want to live like a human being, then your CPI is going to be higher than the CPI of the government. So, you know, you can continue to argue about it, and you need to vote harder about it, and you can do a lot of things about it, but the only thing that works is to just get into Bitcoin.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, inflation is theft, right? Everybody has seemingly tried to, or seemingly is starting to understand that if they haven't already. And, you know, you said Bitcoin is essentially the only way out. Well, I guess I have a little thought experiment for you here. Do you think that there isn't enough time, because of how quickly the debt spiral that we're getting into, for Bitcoin to essentially be the savior of the US dollar, and it's just all roads lead to Bitcoin? Or do you think there's some sort of in-between route that we get to where, you know, maybe we have a Bitcoin strategic reserve and the dollar kind of lasts a little bit longer than maybe it would have otherwise, and then we get to a Bitcoin, a hyper Bitcoinized world, you know, 40, 50 years down the road?
Well, I mean, in the sense of, is it too late? It's not really too late, because I last time I sent a Bitcoin transaction, I think it was, the transaction fee was 2 sats per V-byte, or something like 80 cents or something like that is what I paid. So there's still quite a bit of room. So if you, anybody anywhere in the world right now could transport all their wealth onto the Bitcoin network and pay something like 80 cents in transaction fees to move them onto his wallet. So there's still plenty of room. Anybody can come in. It's not too late for anyone. And you can come in, and I think you can protect yourself significantly from inflation and all kinds of horrific things if you're willing to get into Bitcoin and wait. But I would say, I mean, it's difficult to say whether it's been too fast or too slow, because it depends on your expectations. So in a sense, if you asked me 10 years ago, where do you see Bitcoin in 2025? And you told me it's going to be at $100,000. I mean, I think 10 years ago, I would have thought by this point, it's going to be either that Bitcoin's dead or the dollar's dead. And so, you know, depending on which hat I was wearing, whether it was Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde, whether it was, you know, whether it was the idiot who thought, oh, well, government is going to shut it down, so I obviously shouldn't be buying too much, or whether it was the mentally handicapped genius that just said, no, idiot, just sell everything and buy Bitcoin. You know, unfortunately, at that time, it was a lot more of the university professor educated idiot who comes up with all of these rationalizations for why Bitcoin can't work. And it was more of that. So I would have expected, if you asked me what's more likely, I would have probably at that point, I would have probably said it's going to be closer to zero than a million. And I'd say more likely that it would be zero than million. So it's at 100,000, which is significant, but it's a lot more than I would have expected. But it's not quite enough to have killed fiat yet. So, you know, when you first start getting the idea of Bitcoin, you think that everybody's going to get this. Well, if I got it now, then I'm just going to tell people about it on the internet. I'm going to tell my friends. Then they're going to buy. Then Bitcoin's going to go up. They're going to tell their friends. Bitcoin's going to keep going up, 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 up. And then everybody buys. And, you know, within a couple of months, we're going to be at 10 million and fiat is dead. But it doesn't work that way. I think we've seen these bubbles come and go three times before. So I expect that most likely we're going to be getting another bubble. There's going to be a rise and then maybe a crash. Who knows? But ultimately, I think there are the market dynamics of the Bitcoin supply that govern this. And as the price of Bitcoin goes up significantly, the price of the newly mined Bitcoin goes up. And so Bitcoin becomes inflationary in a sense, because a lot of market value is being added every day from new production. And if demand can't keep up with the increase in the new price, then we're going to get a crash, and then the crash is going to scare people off. So really the only way that this it just needs to play out. My hunch is that it's going to take another couple of cycles, I think. Will a hyperinflation accelerate it? Maybe, but you know, I used to live in Lebanon. I saw hyperinflation there, and yeah, it did accelerate Bitcoin, but it didn't accelerate Bitcoin to the point where it killed fiat. Instead, it moved people from the lira to the dollar. So that's an increase in demand for the dollar, in a sense. And I think we're going to see a bit more of that. So likely, I think what Trump could coast on for a few years is a bunch of inflation in the U.S., a bunch of lower taxes in the U.S., big economic boom in the U.S., and then dump as much dollars as you can on the world. And I think what they're trying to do is to do that through Tether, which I think is going to allow them to dump a little bit of that inflation on people who are going to be happy to take on the dollar, because it's a lot better than the garbage that they have. But it's still, I believe, not such a big deal that it can make a huge difference in the dollar's fate, because the dollar's already something like half of the world's money. There's so many dollars out there. So much of the global financial system runs on dollars. So that even if the entire world dollarizes, it's not that big of an increase in the market share for the dollar. Even if the dollar grows to 100% of all the world's currencies, all the whole planet is using dollars as their local fiat currency in 10 years' time. That's maybe a 50, 100, 150% increase in demand for the dollar. And that's, you know, 10 years of supply increase. So it can eat up 10 years of inflation effectively, but then, you know, the 10 years end and then there's still going to be inflation. So because of that, I still think it's likely to still be wiser to use Bitcoin. But how people use it, I don't know. I think I used to think that, you know, the more that I thought about it, the more that I would have come to the conclusion that okay, maybe there is a middle ground between Bitcoin zero and Bitcoin 10 million. Maybe there is a middle ground. And, you know, as you see these cycles, you start understanding that middle ground is building the market capitalization. This is the Bitcoin global market cap being built through people dumping their fiat and buying more Bitcoin. And that's just going to grow whatever happens with fiat. And so ultimately what matters is that number continues to go up. As long as it continues to go up, then it makes sense for you as a Bitcoiner, as an individual, to hold more of that. And I think that's going to continue to be the case, and people are going to continue to accumulate more and more over time.
Now, you said two interesting things there that I want to dive into a little bit more. You said when fiat dies, and it hasn't died yet. So I'm curious if you have a scenario or something, whether it's Bitcoin price getting to $1 million, where you think that's going to happen. And then you also said Tether is going to play a very important role here, where the U.S. is potentially going to be dumping a bunch of their debt onto the world through Tether. I want you to dive in a little bit more of that and kind of explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I think for me, the battle that Bitcoin is fighting is not the battle to denominate your coffee. That's not the battle itself that you could think of as the trophy ceremony. So you play the World Cup on the football pitch and you win the World Cup, but then you get handed the trophy. You could think of you buying the coffee with Bitcoin as being the trophy that Bitcoin will get when it wins the real competition. And that competition is the cash balances. How much of the world's cash balances are held in Bitcoin? And currently, there's about $2 trillion worth of Bitcoin held by people, which means that that's roughly around 1% of global cash balances. So I estimate roughly about $200 to $300 trillion in cash balances in the world. And in cash balances, what I count is physical cash, but also checking accounts and savings accounts in government money, as well as government bonds. I think that's a huge one. That's one that people use as cash. You could maybe count corporate bonds, but I think government bonds is probably a neater category. Corporate bonds are more of a risk asset. But I think government bonds probably count as cash. You could make a case either way. So, physical cash and checking and saving accounts is about $100 trillion worldwide. Government bonds are about $90 to $100 trillion worldwide. And then you add gold, which is around $20 trillion. And then I think a significant chunk of real estate and stocks are not held because people want to hold them for the sake of their utility and their consumer value. But they are held as stores of value, as cash assets, as something that people save in for the future, as a saving account effectively. So add all of these up, and that's about $300 trillion. So the most liquid market in all of these is the one where people hold the cash that they want to be liquid. And those are two markets. It's the treasury bond market, as well as the physical dollar or the dollars that are on the dollar network. So USD and USD, those are the two parts of this big market. And in the current world, people use about $100 trillion of physical cash and about $30 trillion of US government bond in particular, which you could think of as the most cash-like asset because the US Treasury market is the biggest, most liquid market in the world. So for me, Bitcoin wins when it becomes the biggest, most liquid market in the world. So I think the you take the fort when Bitcoin's market cap is larger than the market cap of the US Treasury bonds. At that point, it's and US Treasury bonds are particularly important because that's where large financial institutions have their cash balances. So if you are the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi, or if you're a giant Chinese state corporation that trades in tens of billions of dollars and you want liquidity in and out of investments all around the world, you want to be able to go and buy a seaport in Mexico and you need to mobilize $20 billion for that. Well, there aren't many places where you can where you can liquidate $20 billion of assets over a couple of weeks and have that money ready. Right? If you try and sell it in pretty much anything, that sort of volume causes the market to causes the liquidity to disappear, and then you're having to sell into low liquidity, and so that means the price crashes significantly. So you want this kind of large liquidity. And so when Bitcoin, it's only about a 15x fold from here. So if Bitcoin does another 15x, which could happen in a weekend with Bitcoin, well, maybe not a weekend, but could happen over 5 years or so. If Bitcoin does a 15x, then it becomes bigger than the treasuries market. And then it makes sense for everybody to hold their cash balances in Bitcoin because then, on the one hand, you have obviously the fact that it appreciates and it continues to go up. And so your cash balances grow in value. And then on the other hand, you will also have access to the largest, most liquid market that is accessible for anybody anywhere that allows you to sell and buy at the largest volume without significant slippage. So for me, when that happens, I think that's you think of it as taking the fort. That's the point where Bitcoin is winning. And then it's all downhill from there to take over the rest of the market because then it's the biggest. of them all. So it's growing so fast when it's so tiny. But then when it gets to the point where it's the biggest, then it's a matter of time before it eats all the others. So even though at that point, let's say it's about $30 trillion, and there's another $250 trillion or so, it's almost another 10x to go. That's probably shouldn't take quite as much as the first period took, because at that point it's already the biggest one, so it's not going to be you're going to see more and more people convert from fiat to Bitcoin, and I think that at some point that might be where we get an acceleration. That might be the tipping point, the S curve. So the S curve happens after we see the treasury market. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I think that would be a good way of thinking of it, that once Bitcoin becomes number one, then everybody needs to join, not just because they want the gains, but also because they need the liquidity.
Now, you mentioned something about the sovereign wealth funds. We recently had BlackRock, Larry Fink, at the house or at the Bloomberg House in Davos say that he's been talking to sovereign wealth funds, and they're talking about 2-5% allocation to Bitcoin. Now, do you think that that's going to be, I guess, the next wave here? Obviously, we've seen other countries, we're seeing nascent states start to talk about building a Bitcoin strategic reserve. How important is it for sovereign wealth funds to start to get into this market and essentially accelerate it as you're describing here?
I think it's important for them to get into it. They should have gotten into it earlier if they like to not be poor, and the sooner they get in the better, and the later they get in the worse. So it's completely incomparable, the returns that you get from holding Bitcoin versus all the other kind of fiat assets that are out there. And so it makes a lot of sense for me that you would want to do that. I can't find the good reason why you wouldn't. And I think eventually they're going to be convinced. It's, you know, it takes a lot to get into Bitcoin and figure out how Bitcoin works. But inevitably, I mean, it's just becoming more and more widely available through all kinds of different places and channels. And so I think they're going to be inevitably finding their way into it, and then a small allocation grows over time, and then you find yourself with a bigger allocation, and that increases your conviction over time, and eventually it eats your portfolio.
Yeah, and I think that that's going to be, you know, a trend that we're starting to see. Another trend that we're seeing that I'm curious your thoughts on, and I know you had a great conversation with Michael Saylor, but it seems like there's a lot of copycats starting to come along those lines, with businesses starting to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet. You know, how do you view this as a potential, you know, I guess, change to the economic system, where instead of having cash reserves, we might see more companies have Bitcoin reserves on their balance sheet?
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. I think Bitcoin reserves, well, Bitcoin is cash. So Bitcoin is the greatest cash in the world. So the best cash reserve would be in Bitcoin. And I think it completely transforms the way that companies work. I've seen this from many people, and I've kind of seen it in my own business, my own online learning platform, safeaddeen.com, where I sell online courses and also sell my books. I think there's something nice about holding your cash balance in Bitcoin, because when you hold your cash balance in Bitcoin, it continues to appreciate over time. And then you're able to think about the long term in a very nice way, wherein you're no longer having to pay an enormous amount of interest payment, and you don't have the massive risk of, I miss a couple of interest payments and then the business gets liquidated and I'm out on the street. You've got the security to be able to think long term, and the security to know that sales dipping for a couple of months is not going to be catastrophic. So this, I think, changes the way the businesses work, and you see it reflected in terms of people just being a lot more low time preference, a lot more future oriented, a lot more focused on adding value, a lot more focused on doing things in the right way, not so obsessed with cutting corners, reducing cost, and degrading quality.
Quick break from this podcast episode to bring you the safest way to buy Bitcoin on the planet. You gotta go to the well, folks. That's right, the Bitcoin well. They will help you buy Bitcoin and send it directly to your personal wallet. You can sell Bitcoin directly from your personal Bitcoin wallet. And on top of that, if you want to buy large amounts of Bitcoin, they've got some of the most competitive rates in the space where they've got great white glove service. I'll even help introduce you to my friends over at the Bitcoin Well to make sure that they're taking care of you when you want to go through the over-the-counter service. And on top of that, they help support you and the freedom technology that Bitcoin offers. So I wouldn't partner with a company that I don't use myself. So I use Bitcoin Well to make all of my Bitcoin purchases. So I highly recommend them. So why don't you go to thebitcoinwell.com/greencandle and you can sign up today and join the party at the well. Maybe even get some tokens where you could throw into the wishing well and potentially win some free sats as well. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show. Now, with that, right, you had a great discussion. I think like you and Michael Saylor, one, had a little bit of a disagreement on how you view Bitcoin going forward. For those who might have missed that conversation, why don't you give a brief overview of that? And yeah, I want to dive into that a little bit more as well.
I guess the key point there was my contention that I think as we transition to a Bitcoin economy, the world becomes a lot less debt-based. The world of finance becomes a lot more equity-based. And I've written this in an academic paper, which I presented at the Property and Freedom Society conference last year in September. And the basic idea here is that the Austrian economists are the ones who explained interest. And they explained interest as being a product of time preference. The reason that you will accept to lend me $100 if I pay you an interest is because you value today more than tomorrow. And so if I'm asking you to sacrifice your $100 today in exchange for getting money back next year, you are going to only accept that trade-off if the money next year exceeds the money today. And that's not just because of inflation. Even assuming that there's no inflation, assuming that the value of the money, hypothetically speaking, maintains its exact value, you still want an interest in order to give up the money today because you value today more. Because today is certain, you may not be here next year, so you've lost the $100 and you've lost all the things that you could have had with the $100. It's also because you could invest the money and so it would generate the return for you. So there's an opportunity cost. So because of this, there's an opportunity cost to holding, to lending money. And that's why, and that's because people have, the time preference is separate from the investment opportunity cost. But the time preference fundamentally comes down to your inherent valuation of the present as being more valuable in the future. And so with this, I think the Austrians explained why interest is so pervasive and why trying to ban interest can be counterproductive, because people do have differences in their valuations in time. And so right now, I value the future a lot less because, say, I broke my leg and I need surgery. So I'm willing to sacrifice money from the future for the sake of surgery today. Whereas for you, you didn't break your leg, so you have the money. You don't need to pay for my surgery. And you don't need the money for something else, but you're willing to sacrifice that money if I'm willing to pay you a little bit extra. So basically, everybody wins in this kind of transaction. But the reason that the transaction happens is because there's a difference in time preference. That's what the Austrians explain. So if you look historically, you see that interest rates have historically been on a downtrend. They've been declining throughout history. And the reason that they decline, I believe, is because human beings become more civilized. Our time preference declines. We become more capable of delaying gratification. We become more future-oriented. We think more about the future. And so we start saving more. And then as we save more, that makes capital more abundant. So the price of capital, which is interest, declines. And this has been a process that has gone on for thousands of years. It's been reported. There's a great book about it called The History of Interest Rates by Homer and Sylla. And so, you know, it fluctuates over time and wars happen, interest rates go up, bad things happen, interest rates go up. But there's been a general downward trend in this. And that downward trend had reached its nadir, if you want, the lowest point of interest rate was at the end of the 19th century, when interest rates at the Bank of England, which was the best creditworthy institution of the time, were as low as 2.5% only. And that's truly historical at that point. And then we're talking about real interest rates at that point in terms of gold. So there was no nominal adjustment because the money wasn't broken. And then World War One comes along and human civilization takes a giant detour and everything goes to the dogs and time preference increases and war raises time preference. And so the 20th century has been an entire a detour away from the path of civilization and declining interest rates towards the world of rising interest rates in real terms. And I think the point of my paper is, well, what would have happened if we didn't go into World War One? What would have happened if the world had continued to reduce its time preference? And I believe what would have happened is that interest rates would have continued to decline until the point where lending money is attractive at 0%, because not lending money means that you have to pay a storage cost on money. And so at that point, I think the interest rate continues to decline to the point where 0% lending is possible in cases where people want to help each other out, because everybody's time preference is so low, so capital is so abundant, and so you can't really get a return on money because there just aren't that many people who need to borrow and there's a lot of people who want to lend. So then if you find somebody who's actually worth lending to, somebody you know, somebody you trust, somebody you think of is credit worthy, but they need money at this point for something that you know, happened to them, their house got destroyed by a natural disaster or something like that, then you would be happy to lend it at 0% because it saves you the cost and the risk of holding the money. So you get a real positive return compared to holding it. And you get a real positive return in terms of the purchasing power, because the purchasing power of money in that kind of world, if it got to a point where our time preference is so low, then the money must be hard. So the purchasing power of the money would be increasing over time. So you are getting a nominal real return. But are you going to give that person that money to go start a business in which he keeps all the profit and he just pays you back the 0%? My contention is no. In that situation, you can invest with the person, you will get an equity stake. So I think eventually, as interest rates are eliminated and as they decline more and more, people will invest in businesses if they're convicted, if they're convinced in these businesses, if they have conviction in the business model, and if they have trust in the person. But at that point, they'll take equity. So I think we'd live in a world where we have a lot of equity. Money appreciates in value. So people who want to have yield on their money right now, you know, they get their yield in a depreciating currency, and then it's a crapshoot whether your yield beats the inflation in real terms, depends on what you spend your money on or not. Whereas in a Bitcoin world, you get zero yield in nominal terms, but in real terms, it's going up every year because the value of money is going up. And then if you want to take on risk, if you want to increase your returns, if you want nominal returns, then you take on equity risk. You get into equity investing. That's how I see it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, in the current system, obviously, you know, Michael Saylor is essentially, the way I view it is almost like shorting the dollar at an extreme rate by shorting the current system to get in the future system. Is there an in-between that you think where we get to this world that you're describing here, where everybody has a lower time preference, where, you know, what Saylor is doing is almost accelerating our path to there? Or do you think that, you know, what he's doing right now is only kind of possible because of the current system that we're in?
Yeah, I think it's basically the fact that getting into the financial markets allows you to just get access to an enormous amount of credit, because the way that the U.S. monetary system is set up is that financial institutions are creating new money when they're lending. So they're always looking for an excuse to get people into the money markets in order to be able to lend. And if you're able to access that part of the fiat gravy train, then you can borrow at very attractive rates. And this is the incredible hack that Michael Saylor has found, where he's found an investment the one investment, essentially, and that's what money is, the one investment where you don't get diminishing returns. Because with every other investment, you know, you've figured out that you could invest in Apple. All right, you keep putting more and more money into Apple. There comes a point at which the Apple stock becomes overvalued compared to the returns, and it can't handle it anymore. There's just, at the end of the day, there are only 8 billion people, and they can't all buy more than one iPhone. Maybe even if they all buy two iPhones, that's 16 billion iPhones. And then at the end of the day, so no matter how much capital you give Apple, no matter how much they grow, there will come a point in which demand for Apple as a store of value is going to overwhelm the fundamental underlying value of the financial asset, which is based on the returns on the sale of its products. And so every other financial asset, if you're in a corporate setting, you can take money, you can invest in all kinds of things. But as soon as you start investing in them, you reduce the profitability of them. The more iPhones are sold, the less profitable the next iPhone. And over time, as the market becomes more and more saturated, then there's not much room for growth left. That's going to happen with every single thing in the world except Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the one thing that doesn't have cash flow. And so it doesn't matter what the asset price is compared to its cash flow. With stocks, that always matters. You know, a company that makes $1 million a year is not going to, you know, if it's expected to be making $1 million a year over the next 20 years or so, that company is never going to trade for $1 billion. No matter how many people want to buy that stock or that company, it's not going to trade for $1 billion if the expectation is that it's only going to be making $1 million a year or so, right? Because ultimately, it needs people to buy its things and not just buy its stock. And so people can't just keep buying the stock. But because you don't have cash flow for Bitcoin, you're not buying Bitcoin for cash flow, the more the stock goes up, the more the value of the underlying asset goes up, then Bitcoin doesn't become less attractive because there's no cash flow to measure it by. It's being bought for its liquidity. It's being bought for the people's ability to sell it on later on. And so as the price goes up, its liquidity increases and your ability to sell it improves. So it's a virtuous circle. So Michael Saylor has found that link, you know, this portal between the fiat world and the Bitcoin world. Because in fiat world, as long as you can keep making a positive return, they can keep giving you bucket loads of cash or credit, I should say, not cash. They give you bucket loads of credit. And as long as Michael Saylor keeps buying, then Bitcoin keeps going up. And he can keep getting more and more fiat. I mean, it sounds too good to be true. And I think it is too good to be true. I don't think it is sustainable after fiat dies. I think there comes a point which everybody figures this game out. And, you know, by that point, Michael Saylor might have 5 million Bitcoins. And when they figure it out, you know, they can't take away his Bitcoin. It's not like the game is going to die. And, you know, he's still going to have his Bitcoin and he's still going to be able to, you know, all of his debt is just going to keep getting devalued more and more. And all of his assets are going to become more and more valuable. So it's a self-solving problem. I don't think it's just, I think the difference is that I don't think it can continue in perpetuity. Because this relies on the existence of the fiat monetary system, which in turn for me relies on the existence of the government bonds. So people need to continue to hold US dollar treasuries in order for the entire fiat circus to continue to work. But if people can just buy Bitcoin or Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy, then why are they going to be buying treasuries? And so until they figure this out, they're going to continue to be basically cannon fodder for Michael Saylor and Bitcoin. But eventually, I think he runs out of cannon fodder, I guess. Eventually, you know, after he's amassed millions of Bitcoins, then, you know, he's got all the Bitcoin or all the Bitcoin is held with people. And the people who have treasuries don't have any wealth anymore, so they can't buy any more Bitcoin. And then he won't find anybody anymore to buy his things, but that's fine. It's not going to be terrible. He's going to have probably cemented himself as the richest man in history.
Now, I have a little thought experiment for you, because you said in there, once everybody starts to figure it out. Now, Mark Zuckerberg at Meta is the only CEO with a higher market cap than MicroStrategy currently has the voting rights that Michael Saylor did when he implemented this Bitcoin strategy and basically started what he's coined as the infinite money glitch, or others have coined as the MicroStrategy flywheel. Now, do you think that if somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, who seemingly could be the only person that could do this, were to start implementing the strategy, that he could, you know, potentially get that richest man on earth title? Or would this just start a snowball effect where all the billionaires would start to try to FOMO into Bitcoin, and then, you know, the tops being blown off, to say the least?
Well, the thing is, with every passing day, the number of people who could catch Michael Saylor declines. At this point, you're probably right. I think Mark Zuckerberg might be the only one who could stop Michael Saylor at this point, because he could also access the capital markets, obviously at a much larger scale than Saylor at this point still. But so what's Meta's cash balance? It's probably something like $100-200 billion, something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I don't have their exact numbers in front of me. I think it's around there.
Yeah, so it's only really a handful of companies that have a cash balance that is large enough where they could buy a quantity of Bitcoin that could rival Michael Saylor, at least theoretically. But in practice, if they start to buy, two things happen. First of all, they likely won't be able to catch Michael Saylor's Bitcoin stash, because they're going to be pumping the price so much that what they thought they could buy with $30 billion, by the time they stop buying with the $30 billion, they may be getting half of what they thought they could get initially, because the price has doubled. So that's on the one hand. And then on the other hand, even if they don't, I think that the thing is, even if they have a significant sum of money, is not only do they pump the Bitcoin, but they also pump Michael Saylor's bags. They pump Michael Saylor's stock. They pump all of his convertible notes, because they all become more and more attractive the more Bitcoin goes up. So it's this unique situation that I've never seen before, where Michael Saylor's moat grows every time somebody tries to cross it. Every time somebody tries to barge in on his territory, then the moat between the territories grows even further. Because every time you try and compete with Michael Saylor by becoming the next Michael Saylor, you can only do that by buying billions and billions of dollars of Bitcoin. And when you do that, you pump Michael Saylor's Bitcoin, but you also pump his stock and his convertible notes and everything else, and you increase his capacity to borrow. So really, it might just only be Mark Zuckerberg who's able to catch him at this point. And, you know, within a few weeks, it might no longer even be him. Who knows?
Yeah, so it seems like this FOMO race is going to start, and it's whether it's businesses, billionaires, or even nation states. Now, as an Austrian economist, we started the beginning of this conversation with the potential of the death of the U.S. dollar. Now, do you see a bright future here with the potential embracement of Bitcoin? Or do you think that, you know, to get to a Bitcoin standard or a hyper-Bitcoinized world, that we're going to have to see the current system collapse in some way, shape, or form?
No, we don't have to see it. That's the topic of my second book, The Fiat Standard, which I really recommend if you want to get into this question, because I argue that we don't really need to see it. I mean, if the collapse happens, then obviously you're going to be happier if you have Bitcoin than if you don't. But even if it doesn't happen, I think, you know, we didn't need a global catastrophic failure of typewriters in order to adopt computers. We didn't need a massive epidemic to kill horses for us to use cars. And the examples are endless. Bicycles, cars, so on. Technology that is better, faster is just going to be adopted. People are going to want to use it over time. That's just how it works. And so the way that I see it is, Bitcoin continues to grow the size of its cash balances and continues to become more and more of a compelling financial asset. Currently, it offers very high, very volatile returns, and relatively low liquidity. It's still not as liquid as the dollar. There's still only $2 trillion, and the dollar is about 100. But over time, it's going to start offering more liquidity, and it's going to start offering less and less returns or appreciation and less volatility as it grows. And I think I just see it continuing to grow over time.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at the Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign. Yeah, and I definitely recommend The Fiat Standard. It's an outstanding book there. But the other book that you helped write was Fiat Food. And I see you're wearing the blue light blockers as well. So how do you think that the, I guess, inflationary aspects of the dollar and, you know, the underlying currency has essentially just killed all of our health? And do you think that this movement that we're having in the United States, the MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again, do you think we're too far gone to a certain extent, or do you think that there's still, I guess, light at the end of the tunnel here?
I mean, if you're still alive, then you're not too far gone. There's always a next meal, and you've always got a choice whether you're going to have, the regular corn and soy sludge that fills your supermarket, which is essentially basically 80% of supermarket stuff is corn, soy, and seed oils. So you can have that in all of its various shapes and forms and flavors, or you can have a steak and meat and make tomorrow a better day. So it's never too late. I think I wrote a chapter in the Fiat Standard in which I described this, why I think there's a very strong link between the devaluation of currency and the deterioration of the quality of food. And I explain it through an economic explanation of, you know, the way in which fiat money raises our time preference, the way in which it raises the prices of foods, the way in which it encourages governments to encourage people to eat the cheaper foods so that they don't show up in inflation. And so it makes all of nutrition science fixated on trying to convince people to eat the cheap, good stuff, because that's the way to get them fed without creating too much trouble. So it's a pretty elaborate argument in that chapter. And a journalist by the name of Matthew Lisiak, he read it and he couldn't believe it initially. And then he started researching it, trying to disprove it. And then he realized that there's just even more to this story than I could even get to in one chapter. And so he emailed me and he said, "Hey, I want to write a book about this. Would you let me publish it with your publishing house?" So I said, "All right, let's do it." And indeed, we did it. And I think it's been a great book. I highly recommend reading it because I think it helps you develop a really strong understanding of the economics of why it is that people are eating garbage. And it's something that goes very well with a side of Bitcoin, I should say, because as you start breaking out of the fiat system and you move away from being a debt slave whose money is constantly devalued and who has no way of providing for his future, as you move towards a Bitcoin saver who's got Bitcoin and can provide for the future, you can accumulate wealth for the future. You can provide for your future self. So you start thinking more and more about your future self, and you start becoming conscious of the food that you want to eat. And as you know, as you stop needing to eat peasant food, you start thinking about how you can eat better. And I think that usually involves eating a lot of meat. I think not usually. I think it definitely has to involve eating more and more meat. In my case, it's been only meat for 9.5 years almost, and I highly recommend that. But I think the important thing is to get more quantities. I mean, it doesn't have to be expensive. Here's the thing. It's still very cheap to get meat. It's just it's the shelf stable mass processed stuff is a lot more profitable and a lot more conducive for trying to keep CPI numbers down because it doesn't respond because it's mass produced. So when the prices go up, producers can keep making more and more, and that brings the price down. And the capital equipment depreciates. Capital equipment keeps getting cheaper to purchase and produce over time. So yeah, so it's a great story. I highly recommend it. And now in terms of what's happening in the US, I think it's a great thing. People are becoming a lot more aware about it. I think that was one of the good things about COVID. It really woke a lot of people up about the depth of the corruption in the medical industry. I used to be pretty afraid of speaking about this too openly back before COVID because you never know. People really like their science and... You know, there's a lot of horrible stigma around anybody who ever suggests that somebody with a medical qualification might be wrong about something. But it's become a lot easier to stick out and call these people full of shit since COVID. And I've certainly done my fair share of that. And I intend to continue to doing it. So I think it's good that people become a lot more skeptical of the pharmaceutical industry, of drugs, of the idea that you can just medicate your way out of sickness and into health rather than eliminate the root causes of your sickness, which I think is a much healthier approach. And I think that's going to proceed. I think people are going to learn to take care of themselves more and more because of the internet, because of knowledge, because of communication, also because of Bitcoin. And because of killing fiat, those all are going to help. Now, whether the current crop of politicians in power are going to move this process forward or backward is difficult to tell. As I said, you know, this is kind of like gambling on rigged games. You never really know. So there are things to be encouraged with. Robert Kennedy Jr. is definitely somebody that I think has done a lot of great work on these issues. And it would be great to have them have some kind of impact. But you hear about some of the other stuff. Larry Ellison talking about a cancer vaccine with AI. That sounds like something straight out of a horror film. And I highly recommend everybody skip whatever Frankenstein monster they intend to come up with. So... It's scary because on the one hand you have this, you on the other one you have that, and you know if we know anything about the way the governments work, particularly the U.S. government, it's the bad guys get their way. So I think we're more likely to see, unfortunately, Larry Ellison succeed with all kinds of horrific Frankenstein experiments rather than seeing RFK make serious changes. But I remain very hopeful. But ultimately, you know, it doesn't really matter much because ultimately you control all of those things yourself. It's your body. You have the choice. And no matter what they do, no matter what they say, no matter how much money they steal from you to try and convince you to take all of these things, it's ultimately your body and your choice. And you can always make sure that that is the case. As long as you have that, then whatever happens in Washington doesn't really matter. So I'm going to continue to eat my steak. I'm going to continue to get my sunshine, and I'm not going to pay much attention to whatever these people say.
Amen to that. Well, Saifedean, you do a lot of great things when it comes to the economic space, but I want to dive into a little bit about who Saifedean is. So, I mean, you talked about you being a carnivore for nearly a decade. What's your favorite piece of meat, man? If you get one meal that it's your favorite thing that you could possibly eat, what are you eating? Is it a steak? Is it a lamb? Is it a pork chop? What are we cooking up tonight?
It's a ribeye, probably. I mean, I go back and forth between a ribeye and a porterhouse, but it's between those two, I think. And I've had a lot of great steak all over the world. Great is very delicious. Steak is very delicious pretty much everywhere. But if I were to choose, I think I would say, like, if I could choose a single steak where I could choose any steak in the world, and it doesn't matter, you know, no issue with money whatsoever, I could choose any steak, even the most expensive steaks. If I could choose one, I think I would choose basic American supermarket beef. maybe the, you know, the triple R, the, no, it's triple A in Canada, but it's prime, I think, in America is the top quality one. I know people like to trash talk supermarket beef all the time. I don't buy that. It's useless snobbery. I think supermarket beef is all right. I love it. And I think it's, there's something about the mass production that makes it especially well done. It's produced to be so reliably good, and they have such enormous volume that it is just excellent. So I think I would just go with prime US beef ribeyes. I'd happily eat them pretty much every meal.
How are you cooking it? They say there's only one right answer, but I gotta get it. I gotta get it from your mouth. How are you cooking it?
Well, the best answer is cook it on firewood. You make firewood. You let the fire burn through, and then you have embers. So you don't cook on live fire. You cook on the embers. That's the best way to do it. And but also there's a great oven that I like. It's called the Otto Wilda. It's a great, great piece of equipment because it's gets to 1500 degrees Fahrenheit, but it has the heat from the top. And so it cooks the steak from the top, and then the fat drips down onto a tray full of water. And so you don't get the flames and the flare-ups that usually ruin the steak. Because usually if you're trying to grill on coal or gas, the fat from the steak falls on the fire, and then it causes big flares to come up, and they burn the steak before the steak is thoroughly cooked. And that's what's good about cooking on embers, is that they don't make big flames and they cook evenly and steadily. But this grill is so great because it just puts the fire on the top and it's really hot, and then all the fat falls down. So you get the exact cooking that you want without any of the flames burning the steak. So I also recommend that one.
Man, that's making my mouth water, and I didn't even think that there was something like that out there. But you're also a very well traveled man. You said, I watched an interview. You said you're kind of born into nomadism. So with that, what's like one experience that really sticks out to you? Like, have you ever gone paragliding in a crazy country, bungee jumping, skydiving, anything like that? Any extreme thing that made your heart race a little bit?
No, I'm not really into these sort of extreme things. My view on those things is that I like to live my life to be meaningful enough that it provides me with all the adrenaline and thrills that I want, and I don't need to risk my life in order to feel alive. So I stay away from these kind of insane experiences. But I travel a lot. I've explored a lot of the world. I've seen a lot of very nice places. Europe, in the US. I'd say the most beautiful place in the world for me is Lebanon, I would say. And I'm not Lebanese. I've spent a lot of time. I've lived in Lebanon for about 15 years. But I would say, and even though I'm not Lebanese, so I'm not biased, but it really is incredibly beautiful as a place. And the more I travel around the world, the more I realize just how beautiful Lebanon is. And people in Lebanon don't quite realize it. But the country is on the nicest spot in the Mediterranean, like in the center of the Mediterranean. The northern coast of the Mediterranean is a little too cold. The southern coast is a little too hot. Lebanon is just right. And it's on the nicest spot in the Mediterranean. And then you have a 3,000-meter high mountain. That's the whole country. The whole country is just the Mediterranean coast, 3,000-meter high mountain, 10,000-foot high, basically. And then behind that, there's a valley. And so the mountain is enormous, and there's an enormous diversity of life there, and trees and animals and birds and nature and waterfalls and rivers and amazing, amazing views all over the country. So many gems to explore. It's a hugely beautiful place. Some of the best food in the world. It's a very, very beautiful place. Very special place.
All right, so I'm going to ask you a first date question. I've never asked this question before, ladies, if you're watching this. But all right, so you describe mountains and beaches on the water. If you had to pick one, then what would it be, mountains or beaches?
Well, that's the thing. That's why Lebanon is so beautiful. You don't have to pick one because you're 40 minutes away from the ski slopes and the beach. And then for several months in the year, a couple of months in the year, the weather is good enough for you to go to the beach and to the ski slopes in the same day. I remember once I was taking my daughter to the beach, and I got into the elevator in my building, and on the floor beneath me, and my neighbor gets in, and she's going in her ski gear, to the ski slopes. We were on the same elevator, and we were going to drive 30 minutes to the beach, and she was going to drive 40 minutes to the ski slopes.
That's electric. Now you got to throw a Bitcoin conference in Lebanon soon, so everybody else has an excuse to come and visit this beautiful place, because it sounds amazing. But you've been very generous with your time, so I really appreciate you coming on. Why don't you tell the people where they could figure out more about you and find out more where they could buy your books and everything else?
Yeah, you can go to saifeddin.com, my website, where I have my online courses, and also you can buy my books, The Bitcoin Standard, The Fiat Standard, Principles of Economics, and soon I'm going to be publishing my fourth book, Gold Standard. And I have my online courses there, and I'm also on Twitter, at saifeddin, and I also have the Bitcoin Standard podcast, which is one episode a week of me discussing things related to Bitcoin you might enjoy.
Yep, and I'll put all that in the show notes. So saifeddin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Brendan. Take care.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here, and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.